You're in the middle of nowhere, with the day fading to a pale band on the horizon. From the descending dark, a bus pulls up, brightly lit inside, but with no name, no destination. The door shuttles open before you. There is no driver. Do you climb aboard? Of course you do. It's why you're here. Welcome to the Gray Line.
Our destination this evening is Shreveport, Louisiana, with a brief stop in Breaux Bridge, otherwise known as the crawfish capital of the world. A dubious claim, if only because there is so little world left to appreciate it. See that redhead teen girl seated in the back of the bus, her nose buried in a paperback book? She's one of the approximately 1.1% of the population that remained behind. Where did everyone else go? And why? I'm afraid she knows little more than you do. Sometimes the truth is just the shape of the hole left when everything we know has gone away. A world-shaped void bounded only by the will to live and the Gray Line.
We picked our way along what I assumed was the main street. Kudzu wreathed the lampposts and draped from the wire of a single stoplight, its glassy eyes blank and dark. A McDonald's stood on the corner, its sign broken so that blue sky shone through the frame, fringed by shards of dusty red.
Summer seems hotter than it used to.
The girl sighed and squinted up at the noon sun, pausing in the intersection. I stopped next to her so that my shadow fell across her. Tall grass carpeted everything. It broke through cracks in the road, the seams of the sidewalks, even the rooftops of the nearby storefronts. Some of the windows were broken. Christmas decorations hung on poles, their tinsel fluttering and dull. I surveyed the intersecting street. Behind the McDonald's was a Walgreens. A flock of crows sat along its roofline, eyeing us.
The doors are broke open,
the girl said, following my gaze.
You think somebody already got to it?
I shrugged.
I doubt it. What I need isn't what most people would be looking for.
Why not?
Because it's not the sort of thing people use to feel good.
It's not drugs, you mean?
I shook my head.
Stay here. I'll just be a few minutes.
She nodded, ambled into the shadow of a dusty UPS truck. Its tires were mostly flat. She climbed up into the open cab and plopped on the driver's seat.
Ow!
She hissed.
Hot.
I began to walk toward the Walgreens. After a few steps, she called,
If you see any Skittles, bring me some.
I nodded. The inside of the Walgreens was dark and still, hot as an oven. Cardboard snowflakes hung from the remaining ceiling tiles. An aisle of Christmas decorations stood behind the checkouts, dim with cobwebs. Apart from the broken front doors, the store seemed mostly untouched, filled only with the strange inertia of abandon. The pharmacy was in the back, dense with gloom. I tugged the little mag light from my pocket, clicked it on, and shone it around. The shelves had been ransacked messily. Pills and brown bottles littered the floor, scraping and crunching underfoot. I found the section I was looking for, groped around behind a jumble of boxes, felt nothing but dust and grit. Thin glass crunched underfoot. I bent down and aimed the maglight. It glinted off a strew of small bottles, all broken. I found a shard with the label still attached, read it, sighed, and dropped it. On the way out, I found a rack of batteries, rooted around for some backup AA's. I disturbed a skunk. It clattered from beneath a shelf of greeting cards and hurried away toward the light of the doorway, leaving only a whiff of its signature stink. The girl saw me coming back and hopped down from the UPS truck.
Did you find what you need?
I shrugged, then nodded.
I tossed her a green plastic bag, and she caught it deftly.
Sour Skittles. Don't eat them all, or you'll make yourself sick.
She tore open the bag, shook some into her hand, popped it against her open mouth. She chewed meditatively. A vehicle was approaching. We both heard it and turned to look. It was an old pickup truck, moving fast, weaving hard through the abandoned traffic. I put a hand out behind me, found her shoulder, pushed her back again into the shadow of the UPS truck. The pickup truck reached an open stretch of road, accelerated, passing us with a roar of exhaust. Then, suddenly, the brakes locked, grinding the tires along the road and slewing a little sideways. I watched. Behind me, the girl stood with her right hand buried in the bag of Skittles, rooting absently. The pickup shifted into reverse and the engine revved. It backed up, too fast, a little drunkenly, and jerked again to a halt in front of us. The driver was a young man, with a black beard, thick as a bramble bush. His eyes were wide, feverish. He wasn't wearing a shirt. For all I knew, he was completely naked.
How far is it?
He begged. His voice was high and hoarse, ragged between panting breaths. I pointed down the road ahead of him.
Just a little farther. Keep straight and you'll be there in no time. There are a few boats left. I'm sure they'll have room for you.
The man didn't reply. He merely whipped his head forward, gripped the steering wheel, rammed the shifter into gear, and stomped the gas. The truck spewed pebbles and surged forward. Within seconds, it was merely a drifting cloud of dust, barreling away between overgrown fields. We started to walk again, heading in the opposite direction of the truck, into the small town of Brobridge, Louisiana, crawfish capital of the world, according to the sign we'd passed a quarter mile back. The girl popped another handful of Skittles.
Why did you tell him there was a boat?
I shrugged.
Maybe there is.
What will he do if there's not?
I didn't answer. We walked past a car wash, its bays lush with swaying yellow grass. She said,
"He'll just try to swim, like my mom and dad. He'll try to swim all the way there."
I pressed my lips together, armed sweat from my brow. That evening, we found a few other people camped out in a big house along a boulevard. Pictures on the refrigerator showed a family of five on vacation somewhere sunny, mugging to the camera, wearing souvenir hats. The oldest of the kids looked about nine. On the house's back patio, a fire had been built in a brick barbecue. A collection of canned beans and creamed corn sat nearby, waiting to be warmed. Deck chairs had been pulled up to the edge of the heat. Weeping willows dominated the expansive yard, swaying with hot breeze. There were three people there, accepting us easily with little explanation. Introductions weren't necessary. All that mattered was that we weren't runners. I sat down on a low stone wall. The girl hunkered down cross-legged on the patio, unslung her backpack, tugged out her book, and began to read. By the firelight, I saw a pair of women, mid-20s. They didn't seem to be related. The fire was tended by a middle-aged man, not much younger than me. His yellow polo shirt was expensive, but grubby.
18 months,
he said, poking the fire with a stick.
Feels like weeks, doesn't it?
He smiled back at me, and I nodded.
You all traveling together?
Nah, I mean, we're together, but we aren't traveling.
He sat back and sighed.
This is Shayna and Carol. We met down at the Superette a few months back. Figured we might as well sit it out together.
Sit it out?
The girl turned a page in her book, but I knew she was listening.
Well, things can't stay like this forever. It's not like the end of the world or anything. Not like a war or disaster happened or anything. The people who stayed behind, they'll get things back up and running eventually.
The woman named Shayna nodded, her dark eyes flickering with the fire.
Maybe the others will come back. Maybe they're still out there. Maybe the spell will break and they'll just all come back.
There was silence for a few minutes, punctuated only by the snap of the fire and the whisper of the willows.
I had a wife,
the man said, and laughed a little.
Still do, I suppose. Somewhere. I remember the morning she left. I was making eggs, getting ready for work, and she says, "So, I guess I'll meet you at the airport then." I looked at her and was like, "What are you talking about? The airport? Who's going to the airport?" She didn't even look at me. She'd got a cooler and was piling stuff into it from the pantry. Crackers and peanut butter, protein bars, whatever. Just sort of random stuff, you know? And I just sort of forgot about it. I went to work and didn't give it another thought. Sounds crazy now, but come on. You married?
He looked aside at me. I shook my head. He shrugged.
Well, believe me, when you're married, there's a lot of times when your wife gets talking about stuff and you just let it wash over you. When your wife says, "I'm going to the airport," you think she's meeting a friend or something. You don't ask about it because you don't want her to say, "You know, I told you about it the other day. Weren't you even listening to me?"
He laughed again, but weakly, and shook his head.
You never think that she's gone crazy and is heading out to some random spot in the middle of the Indian Ocean? Her and the rest of the world?
The girl lowered her book and looked up.
It's a localized psychosis, like Jerusalem syndrome. Have you ever heard of Jerusalem syndrome? Joe told me about it.
The older woman, whose name I had already forgotten, looked aside at the girl, then at me.
It's one of those weird things that happened. I used to be a geography teacher, and I used to tell my students about it. Strange mental illnesses that only occur in really specific places, like Jerusalem. Otherwise, sane tourists go there, tour the Holy Land, and suddenly get this intense delusion that they're Jesus. A wife wakes up in her hotel in Tel Aviv, and her husband's missing. A day later, they find him in a robe, out preaching on the streets.
The woman listened, expressionless. Then she asked,
"So what cures them?"
I shrugged.
"Getting them out of the place where the delusions happen. Put them on a plane back to Dubuque, Iowa, or whatever. By the time they land, the delusion's broken."
Shayna was still looking at the fire.
"So, the people that left us went out into the middle of the ocean. How do we break them out of their, what do you call it? Their delusion?"
The girl sitting by my knees looked down and opened her book again. She turned a page. The man laughed ruefully.
"You mean, how do you cure somebody of a localized psychosis when it's localized to the whole planet?"
Nobody had an answer to that. We ate the beans and corn, then had stale graham crackers for dessert. Fortunately, food wasn't a problem. Most of the runners had left plenty behind. Medicine, however, that was a different story. The man's name was Ron. When dawn came the next morning, he was in the kitchen.
"You two heading out?"
he asked.
"We heard about a place on the radio, outside Shreveport, a gathering for the people who are left. They're trying to put together a new government."
Ron grimaced and shook his head.
"I heard about that too, but that was months ago. All the signals have stopped now. There's always rumors like that, you know."
I sighed and nodded.
"Better than just waiting around, I guess."
The girl shouldered her backpack and said,
"Joe needs to find his medicine."
Ron looked at me, his expression changing.
"What kind of medicine?"
I turned to look out the sliding glass back door.
I have something called Graves' disease. Had a thyroidectomy a few years ago. I need to take a synthetic hormone to replace what my thyroid used to make."
"Will you die without it?"
The girl answered for me.
"He gets weak. He stops wanting to eat. His body hurts."
Ron looked from her to me again.
"But will you die without it?"
I looked at his reflection in the glass of the door and smiled.
"Everybody dies without something."
Ron cocked his head at the girl.
"You his daughter?"
"No, I'm Rhiannon,"
she answered, and took a granola bar from the counter.
"He's my teacher."
An hour later, the sun was climbing into the sky and the day was turning humid. Heat baked up from the broken pavement. Grasshoppers scattered from the weeds that encroached the road. We passed a barn with a Chevy Suburban parked in front of it. The doors weren't locked. The keys were in the center console. I tried to start it, and it turned over on the third try. The radio blurred to life, playing only static. Rhiannon turned it off. There was a third of a tank of gas. We drove slowly, navigating between the encroaching brush, weaving around the occasional abandoned cars and trucks. We found another small town and another drugstore, this one a CVS. The windows were smashed and the aisles looted. The pharmacy was a shamble of overturned shelves and spilled boxes. Pills littered the floor, anonymous and useless. They crunched and crumbled underfoot. My joints sang an opera of grinding pain and growing weakness. We found a farmhouse and some cans of ham. We sat in the shade of the yard and Rhiannon ate. I nibbled.
Is it getting bad?
She asked. I shrugged.
You're getting dirt on your ham.
She held up a slice.
I don't mind. I like dirt. I trust it.
The next morning, I was searching the garage for a gas can when Rhiannon called to me. I hurried out front and found her staring at a white BMW idling by the mailbox. The driver was a woman of about 40, her long blonde hair pulled into a messy ponytail. Her name was Linda. She said she had come back.
Come back from where?
I asked suspiciously. She shrugged and glanced up at the Beamer's rearview mirror, then back at me again.
From where else?
We went back into the house and I found some instant coffee in the cupboard. I found some mugs as well, but dropped one as I pulled them out. It shattered on the linoleum. My hands were visibly shaking. Linda saw, but didn't say anything. Rhiannon took over. She heated some water over the remains of the previous night's fire. And Linda told her story.
I was like everyone else,
she said.
I woke up that December 11th and just knew I had to go. There was a direction in my head calling me to it strong as a magnet. It wasn't unpleasant. It was actually sort of comforting. I mean, I don't know about you, but I spent a lot of my life wondering what I was supposed to do next. Was I making the right choices? Had I found a purpose? And then that morning, it was all suddenly so clear. I knew what I was made for. I was made to go to the source. I wondered if I was crazy. I had responsibilities, a job, a life. But then I turned on the news and found out I wasn't alone. Everybody had gotten the same message. Some scientists had figured out the latitude and longitude. It was the middle of the Indian Ocean. But nobody cared. We all knew it would make sense when we got there. All the airlines were redirecting their flights to the coast. From there, every boat was being commissioned for the trip. Everything from cruise ships to oil tankers. Nobody asked why. We just went. I don't remember much about the journey. I ended up on a cargo ship. I remember sleeping in the hold with hundreds of other people. It was a little like college, like living in a dorm. Everybody was sort of happy, excited, almost a little drugged. So, a lot like college, really. But then we got there, or at least we got close. We were completely overjoyed. We could sense how close we were. We could almost see it, but there were just so damn many of us. There were ships and boats everywhere. And we were all trying to get to the same place. Not the same general area, or even the same square mile, but the same absolute spot. And the closer we got, the more irresistible the pull was. And that's when things started to fall apart. There were big military ships there first, circling each other, crowded around the source, trying to beat each other to it. I remember stories of negotiations happening between world leaders. The president was there, and he was threatening military strikes on any nation that occupied the source, blocking our way. There were jets overhead, flying low. They'd come from aircraft carriers, and they had markings from all different nations. We watched them fly over loud enough to break our eardrums, and we thought nothing of it. We watched like lemmings. Millions of us crowded onto thousands and thousands of ships. Some of the boats were too small. They got crushed between the bigger ones, and we all barely noticed. All we knew was that we were so close. So close. The source called us. It needed us. And we needed it. And honestly...
Linda paused and shook her head and stared down at her lukewarm coffee. She looked up at me plaintively.
I can't understand it now, but when the smaller ships got crushed and sank, we were glad. We didn't talk about it, but I could see it in everyone's eyes, and they could see it in mine, I'm sure. It meant less people were in the way. It meant we were that much closer to where we had to be. But then the bombing started. It wasn't just one nation, it was all of them. They targeted each other's carriers and battleships. But we were all so close. You could hardly see the ocean. The boats were so packed together, nearly hull to hull, scraping each other in the waves. Explosions lit the sky like fireworks, and once it began, it was nonstop. But no one screamed. That's the thing that finally shook me out of it, I think. Nobody screamed. Nobody cried. Not even when the people on their own ships got hurt or killed. Everyone just watched and waited. They waited because they hoped that when the bombing stopped, they'd be the only ones left. And that wouldn't be a bad thing. That would be a good thing. Because the source was too small for all of us. We couldn't all go there. We couldn't all fit. The source might only be big enough for one person. If everyone else died, then maybe that one person could be me. That was all that mattered. But one of the boats wasn't just sitting there waiting to get bombed or not. It was steaming through the mass, full power, bashing smaller ships aside, crushing the broken and burning ones under its bow. It was one of those icebreaker ships, huge and heavy, with a sharp, reinforced bow. I noticed that it was steaming away from the source, not toward it. There were people on the deck. One of them had an electric bullhorn, and he was shouting, "Get out of the way! If you want to leave with us, wave something! We have more room! Wave something, and we'll take you aboard! Otherwise, get out of the way!" I took off my shirt, the same shirt I've been wearing for days, and waved it. I waved it like crazy, standing there and hollering. The people on my own ship stared at me like zombies. The icebreaker slowed down and passed right alongside our ship. The hull scraped and ground against each other. I almost fell when I climbed across, but they grabbed my arms and pulled me over. They had plenty of room on their ship. Hardly anyone wanted to go back.
Linda stopped again and slumped in her chair. She leaned on the old Formica kitchen table, then raised the coffee. She drank almost all of it in a series of gulps. Rhiannon asked,
"How many were there on the icebreaker with you?"
Linda looked at her, then at her mostly empty mug. She shook her head.
30, maybe a few more.
I said,
"There must be other ships, other people who broke out of the delusion. They'll be coming back too."
Linda nodded faintly, not meeting my eyes. She shrugged. I told her about Shreveport, about the community that was gathering there, according to the radio. We went in her car. I was shaking bad enough that I couldn't drive. On the outside of Shreveport, we found a billboard. Originally an advertisement for a Red Roof Inn, it had since been repurposed with black spray paint words, "New Governing Council HQ at Municipal Building. Food and medical avail. No weapons allowed." We followed the signs and found the municipal building. Its doors were chocked open. We parked and climbed the steps, but I could tell by the silence that it was empty. We looked around. found nothing. Rhiannon asked,
"Do you think something bad happened to them?"
I shook my head and sighed. Linda hunkered on the ledge of the open doors and blew a hair out of her face.
"It doesn't look like they were attacked. It looks like they bugged out, took everything with them."
Rhiannon sat on her backpack.
"But why wouldn't they leave a sign or anything? What could make them just run away?"
Linda shrugged. An idea seemed to strike her, and she met my eyes pensively. I thought I could tell what she was thinking. Maybe she and her friends in the icebreaker weren't the only ones who had come back. Maybe there were others. And maybe they weren't all as friendly. Maybe the new governing council had decided it wasn't exactly safe to advertise their new location. Rhiannon took out her book. It was a paperback copy of Lord of the Flies. She didn't open it. To me, she said,
"Do you want to look for a drugstore?"
I shook my head. It was getting hard to walk, and we were nearly out of gas. My fingers ached and shook. I balled my hands into fists. I sat in the sun while Rhiannon and Linda searched the municipal building. After about an hour, I heard them coming back. I wondered if I'd be able to stand up again. Linda sat down on the steps next to me. She had her purse with her. It was a small thing made of tanned leather. She opened it.
"Can you believe this thing has traveled with me all the way to the middle of the ocean and back?"
She laughed to herself.
"Old habits die the hardest."
She snaffled briefly through her purse, then pulled out a small brown bottle. She held it up and peered at it, shook it. It rattled densely, half full.
"Levothyroxine,"
she said, and I glanced aside at her, startled. She offered the bottle to me.
"Rhiannon told me. Weird thing is, my husband died a year before everything happened. Not of his hypothyroidism. He got hit by a car while biking."
She shook the bottle in her hand again and smiled at it.
"I've been carrying this around with me ever since, like a sort of memorial. I guess now I know why."
Feeling numb, I took the bottle, opened it, dry swallowed one of the little white pills. Maybe it was my imagination, but I started to feel better almost immediately, at least a little. Linda nodded and looked out over the abandoned streets of Shreveport. A family of deer was grazing in the tall weeds below a gas station canopy. She asked,
"So is Rhiannon your daughter?"
I leaned back and raised my face to the sun, closing my eyes.
"I'm her geography teacher."
Linda nodded.
"Close enough, then."
I nodded as well. A little while later, Rhiannon approached and plopped down next to us.
"Skittles?"
she said, offering us the green bag. For the first time in days, I realized I was hungry. Between the three of us, we finished the bag.
Alas, a tale whose only answers unlock endless new questions. And yet, we can take comfort, at least, in some small resolutions. A serendipitously found medicine. A facsimile of a family forged out of ashes. And the hope that there may be a new civilization grown from the stable few who remain. Admittedly, that does seem a bit optimistic, especially considering the parts of Linda's story she didn't tell. But fortunately, that doesn't concern you, dear traveler. Thank you for riding with us, and do collect your luggage, should you have any. And please remember, not every journey ends so pleasantly. The next time you ride with us, you may find yourself lost forever. Just one more tale told on the forgotten back roads of the Grey Line. This has been episode 1 of season 2 of the Grey Line, thanks to the many of you who've discovered our true stories from the untrue dimensions. Everybody Dies Without Something was written and produced by me, G. Norman Lippert, and featured the voice talents of Jeannie Lynn, Joy Craig, Jess Sargent as Ron, Greer Lippert as Rhiannon, and J.L. Norman Lippert as Linda. If you are enjoying The Gray Line, please subscribe. Leave us an encouraging rating and review. Suggest your town as an upcoming destination, if you dare. And, as always, say it with me, tell all of your friends, and a few choice enemies.